Q&A portion of this seminar. And so we do have 130 people on webinar. And so we'll start with webinar. And when you have a question in the room, just please raise your hand and wait for me or Crystal, my colleague, to pass you the microphone and state your name and organizational affiliation.
So the first question comes from Peter Mabuyu from Nairobi with the Kenya Markets Trust.
I can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay, great. The first question is from Peter Mabuyu from Nairobi with the Kenya Markets Trust. At what time in your intervention do you say or know you have reached the critical mass? What should you be looking out for?
Well, as I alluded to, that is a case-by-case basis. It depends on basically what kind of multiplier effect you're getting. Obviously, if you're first, you're not going to get much of a multiplier effect in year one, maybe. But by year two or three, you should, you know, if you've put a demonstration plot in place in 50 or 500 villages, whatever the numbers are, you should start to get a sense of, oh, so we did two crop cycles in this area. How many of the people in that village who weren't part of that demonstration program or in the next village are adopting? If the numbers are 5 to 1, then you sort of need to cover 20%, obviously. If the numbers are 3 to 1, the numbers are higher. If you're getting 10 to 1, then the numbers are small. The only point I'd make, however, is it, as I tried to emphasize, it isn't just a question of 10%, 20%, 30%, but remember, there's a mechanism there. So one of the things that has sometimes happened, because there hasn't been an explicit geographic strategy for putting in place these nodes, or if you prefer, points of light, for scaling, is they tend not to be uniformly distributed. They're clumpy. So if they're clumpy, that means you may have gaps where you have no place. And so even though you may have hit your 20%, there's no village or demonstration center within the area you need to influence the farmers in that area. So it isn't purely the numbers. It's also making sure that there's proximity in the sense of the social network or whatever the mechanism by which farmers are learning about this that allows for that transmission to take place.
Hi, my name is John Lamb. I'm with Apt Associates. I have a question on your use of the terminology of multipliers. When you started talking about indirect multipliers, I thought you were heading in the direction of something like the implant system for regional economic analysis in the U.S., of direct, indirect, and induced. But in fact, it sounds like you're using it to as a means of measuring indirect adoption of the technology. Is there not, first of all, a danger of causing confusion amongst economists who are used to the more traditional thing? And second of all, is there any activity occurring in the the FSB to look at actual ways of increase in the multiplier effects in terms of rural prosperity, jobs for women, and so on, that are more in keeping with the traditional use of multipliers?
I think your first point is very well taken. I think one of the things we struggle with in scaling up in general is that there isn't a common lexicon or language, and so we for example, I think if we went around the room and we asked people to define the word replication, we'd get about 6 different definitions. As a trained economist, I understand completely what you mean about multipliers, but I'm not sure what the other word I should be using or could be using, but we could probably take that up offline. To answer your second question about the normal use of multipliers or induced effects in terms of job creation, et cetera, the answer is yes. Actually, we are starting to take a look at that also. I had 35 minutes, couldn't cover everything, but I think for political reasons, but not only for political reasons, for important reasons, you know, the emphasis has really been on scaling technology and how many, you know, and on addressing poverty and food security. Now, I understand that job creation, direct and indirect, does address poverty, but particularly the issue of food security, you know, there's only so much of a burden you can put on implementers in terms of data collection. I've already proposed disaggregating the beneficiaries to the indirect beneficiaries, which ones are adopting who, what, where, and why. That's a lot to ask. And then saying, okay, and so how many jobs are being created indirectly? But you're seeing it. I mean, you're definitely seeing it. And certainly some of the projects are starting to measure it. And I think there is an ongoing discussion within BFS and 3E and the agency as a whole of how to get a better handle on those things as well. The problem is trying to create this balance between the burden of monitoring and evaluation on the one hand and capturing these systemic effects on the other, and it's not an easy balance to strike, but both your points are very well taken.
This question comes from Christina Manfrey at Cultural Practice in Bethesda. How does the framework account for differences among farmers? Specifically, I'm wondering how you reach scale or that critical mass in a way that you know you're reaching both men and women.
So that's a great question. I'd say that it's difficult. It's complicated precisely because, as I tried to say before, it's not clear that one size fits all. In a sense that even though sometimes the projects are fairly nuanced and subtle in their design, so for example, the Cambodia project I alluded to has both horticulture in terms of people producing for the market and also market gardens for farmers that don't have the resources and the vibe, both in terms of land, labor, and financial resources to do a production. So, but in a lot of cases, there isn't the distinction being made in terms of how do we approach farmers who might be women versus men, or a dollar, less than a dollar and a quarter versus $2 or less versus maybe in the $2 to $5 range, farmers who have less than a hectare of land versus, let's say, 2 to 5 hectares of land, et cetera. And it turns out that these projects are having, I think, variable success in terms of who they reach. And I think we need to, one of the things we're rethinking is a project may be really good for a certain subset of farmers, be they men or women, and bringing them to commercial into the commercial value chain and producing and increasing incomes and yields quite dramatically, but that might not work so well for dollar and a quarter farmers. They're too old, they're too under resources, they lack literature, and we sometimes need a different approach. The project Feed the Future has a very, very explicit and strong gender component to it, and goes out of its and every project I know of has strong numerical targets. What we're trying to do for women, what we're trying to do, though, however, is get away from simply checking the box, which is, you know, I had 50 demonstration projects and I made sure that 50% of the people there were women, to what are the economic activities that women actually engage in, and how can we make sure that we're supporting those activities in a way that allows them to come out of poverty or to improve their nutritional status, et cetera. In some places, that's easier to do in others. But I just would point out that in many, many countries, and certainly in much of Southeast Asia, in South Asia, you're getting the feminization of agriculture. You go to rural Kenya, rural Cambodia, you don't see many men. The average farmer in Kenya is 61 years old and a woman, because a lot of the people who have migrated to cities are either men, or there are men who died of HIV until antiretrovirals became more common. So it's an issue. It's an issue that the Feed the Future takes extremely seriously and is addressing proactively. But the bigger challenge is, does a one-size-fits-all work for women? And if not, how do you have a more nuanced project that addresses not just men versus women, but the other subcategories of the poor population that you want to address?
Let's take a question in the room.
Hi. This is Thulika Narayan, also from Apt Associates. I guess my question is somewhat related to this, but I wanted to bring the issue a little bit more to the center, that when you're looking at early adopters and you're looking at getting to a critical mass, the typology of the farmer who would adopt would be credit unconstrained, even if he has 1 to 2 hectares, is somebody who has alternate sources of income. So in the first 5 years, the short-term strategy, your target beneficiary will be probably very different from what the Feed the Future or USAID wants to target, because they are the ones who are going to be unconstrained, have other approaches. So how do you sort of address that particular issue? And one second piece is that as you start taking things to scale, is there some analysis done vis-a-vis when everybody adopts, is there going to be an issue of glut in the market? Is the market intelligence adequate for farmers to then adjust if there is actually a glut in the future? So those are the two keys.
Thank you. So those are both great questions. To take the first one, I think, as I've tried to say, a lot of the work we're doing now is how to make scaling up of Feed the Future a both and. Okay, so we understand that scaling up often takes more than 5 years. We understand that building the ecosystem often takes more than 5 years and relieving the various constraints. We understand that the first tiers of farmers, especially if you're trying to pursue this critical mass or this triggering strategy, the late adopters will tend to be the ones that you're often the most interested, etc. So the question is striking the right balance. So the first thing we're trying to do is create a coherent story, which is, well, this is our theory of change. In other words, our theory of change is not simply, and we're going to hit 250,000 farmers, thank you very much, and walk away, because we've learned that we come back 5 years later and half of those poor farmers aren't doing it anymore. We are trying to move towards a more sustainable thing. Secondly, our theory of change involves building ecosystems, and we have to measure that. At the same time, as I've alluded to, we live in the reality of a Congress that gets elected for every 2 years, that wants to know where the money went and wants to see tangible results. So what we're trying to do is, as I alluded to, develop indicators that we're on the right path of this theory of change, that we have shown in a certain subset that actually, if you do get the unconstrained farmers, as you called them, to adopt, that actually does lead to a multiplier effect of 3 or 5 or 10 to the less resourced, less constrained poor farmers that we care about. We may not be able to do that everywhere in the first few years, but we have enough of a proof of concept that it's not just that some farmers are adopting, but that sequence that we think we're on the first, you know, that little curve that I had up on the graphic, we actually are somewhere along, we're on that path. And we want to develop indicators for each part of that path to know that we're on track. At the same time, we need to produce some early results to show that we can, that this is going to work. Could you remind me of the second part of your question?
Second one was related to farmers having the market intelligence.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Okay. So each country, each project does do research on the options of size. And is there, I think, more could be done from an economics perspective, frankly, that often that's done in year one, but the markets are fluid. And, you know, what works, what may have been a reasonable forecast of where the market, you know, is growth is likely to come in the next few years. I think there's still more work to be done here, because, you know, what I love about the approach that we've moved to is we've gone from teaching giving people fish to teaching people how to fish to teaching people to run a fishing business to both teaching people how to run a fishing business and building a viable fishing market system in which their business can survive and thrive. What we're pretty good at or getting better and better at is doing that in a static sense. In other words, putting the pieces in place. Getting into place something that works on a dynamic basis, as I alluded to, for example, our primary focus in these projects is getting these new technologies adopted. I think it's raising the bar, and it's a bar we should eventually raise to say, well, what about when the next technology comes down the road in 2 years or 3 years or 5 years? We'd like to think there'll be new seed varieties every few years that are better and better, and these farmers will continue have a continuous adoption cycle. We're not anywhere close to that, okay? And I think it's the same thing with the question you asked, which is helping farmers be adaptive, dynamic businessmen. That's a harder slog. Now, most of these projects are often organizing farmers into associations for a variety of reasons. But think of it, and that's sort of standard practice, and for good reason. But frankly, I've never seen a country, when I go to a country, and if they're hitting a 20, 30, 40% success rate in terms of long-term viability of farmers' associations, I think they're hitting it out of the park. Okay? In the U.S., you start a small business, and you have an 85% success rate after a failure rate after a few years. This is a much more difficult place to operate, and you're trying to get 100, 200, 300, 500 people to work together effectively. So why would you expect to get any better than 15% success of associations in terms of viable long-term businesses? So I think these are real issues. I do think there needs to be a little bit more research on the market implications. There's a tendency, I think, in Feed the Future, despite the fact that the framework is set up to have a very strong market, financial, and economic orientation, there's, I think, a historical legacy of seeing this more as a agricultural technology implementation drive. And so, you know, it's moving the supertanker. It's getting people who traditionally, you know, oriented, this is a better technology, you should adopt to this, to this is you can make money, you should adopt this, to here's how to run a business and change the crops you go, the technology you use on an ongoing responsive basis. We're very much in process on that. But great questions. Thank you.
The next question comes from Stephen Lunder, an independent consultant. Can you say a bit more about how one defines and adapts an offering of a bundled package of goods and services that simultaneously meets the varied priority needs of producers, like input goods and services, access to financial services and markets, et cetera, and the needs of critical providers and vendors. It sounded rather technocratic versus an incremental approach that builds upon evidence and success.
The short answer is, these are all great questions. I don't think I have a template or a cookie cutter for that. I think it's been on a case-by-case basis, which is the single thing unbundled working, or if not, what could you bundle with it that makes sense? And actually, the questioner is right. It usually is on a incremental basis. So let me give an example, okay? In Bangladesh, one of the technologies that the some of the Feed the Future projects, there are several there, has introduced is what's called urea deep placement. And I know that's an issue or a technology that has a strong and a very divergent opinions upon within the community, but it seems to be working in Bangladesh for whatever the reasons, okay? However, there are obstacles, one of the obstacles being that it's extremely labor intensive. And while the implementing partners there are working and have been working steadily for several years to develop new and better, literally tools that allow, sorry, I should say what it is. Urea deep placement is you take urea fertilizer, which is the primary fertilizer, which is nitrogen rich, and you compress it into a small briquette. It's about a quarter or less of the size of what our charcoal briquette that we would use for grill. And you stick it about 3 or 4 inches into the ground. It's often used with rice, but can be used with other things, in between the four rice plants. And the big advantages of that is that it dissolves slowly over time. You don't get the runoff. You get much higher absorption rates. And actually, it costs less because since there's less runoff, you only have to use 60 or 70% as much fertilizer, and it actually increases, when effective, yields by about 20 or 25% because you get higher absorption. Okay, that's the theory. The practice is, as I said, a lot more challenging. So the farmers, as I was alluding to in general, complain about the problem is they can't find labor. They've already run around their hectare, 2 hectares, 3 hectares, you know, hand planting all these rice seedlings to do it again. You know, with a bunch of rice is literally backbreaking work. Okay, so they are looking for labor to do it, and they can't find it. Well, some of the agro dealers who are selling the fertilizer briquettes, the urea briquettes, have innovated bundles, which is that they have organized their own labor gangs, which is saying not only will we sell you the 500 kg of briquettes you need, but we have a team which is specialized that can actually do the planting for you, the placement for you, and we can do it in a half a day because we do it all the time. And we're really there. It turns out, for whatever reasons, there are some people really good at it and some people not so good at it. And the more you do it, obviously, the better you get. So that's been a case where bundling has been very helpful. And actually, something very similar has been tried in Tanzania. They are using the briquettes there too, but it has more to do with the fact that they're actually shifting from broadcast planting to seedlings. And also evenly spaced seedlings, et cetera, and most of the farmers aren't used to that. So one of the goals of the Tanzanian project is to actually encourage youth to stay in agriculture, and this is actually a very profitable activity for young people because it's fairly hard work, is to be organized into these labor gangs to do seedling planting using spacing and all this, and they're very good at it, and this has been a very big success. Can I generalize from that? I don't know yet. Maybe that's a conversation I need to have with Johannes Lynn, Larry Cooley, Justin, and the lab about how do we think about what are the right bundles of things, whether it's for an agri-dealer, for a farmer, for a buyer, et cetera, in terms of what makes sense financially and what's the process we can use to identify that.
Eric Hyman, USAID E3 Economic Policy. To what extent are the more recent Feed the Future projects providing small-scale irrigation, which will become increasingly important as a climate change adaptation strategy, and also integrating with the necessary financing using alternative forms of collateral and using communication strategies that reach indirect beneficiaries in the beginning?
I think that was three questions in one. So let me take the first one, because actually it's a very interesting one because it relates to the previous question, which is one of bundling. Okay. Even drip irrigation, there's a variety of shapes and sizes, right? You can go farmer by farmer and give them a little cistern that he or she fills with water. Maybe it's some rainwater collection, or they go to the river or something and they carry it, and they once a week they have to fill their, 50-liter cistern, and then it drips all week and all that. And then there are these large pits that they dig with a line with, some sort of waterproof material, and then maybe 5 or 10 people use that, or 5 or 10 people have a larger cistern, and so there are varying shapes and sizes. Now, this is a perfect example where technology versus incentives and intangibles comes into place. Once you get into, let's say, having a large cooperative of 100, 200, 500 people have a very large common source of drip irrigation water, then you get into all sorts of management and pricing issues and measurement. How much water are they using? How much are they going to pay for it? Who's going to manage it? Who's going to build the infrastructure? Who's going to maintain the infrastructure? And so that gets back into the viability of the Farmers Association as an effective delivery mechanism. On the other hand, if you do it case by case, it's actually much more expensive to put in place 500 cisterns than 3 large ones. Okay. So I think one of the questions, the first answer to your question is that many, but not all of the projects are using drip. Drip tends to be used more in horticulture, for example, than it does in staple cereals, for obvious reasons. But at least in those areas where it tends to make more sense, it is being used. But this issue that I just alluded to of how do you organize it and what's the right size, not just from a technology perspective, but from an organizational capacity and management perspective, I think is really a key issue. And that is... Yeah, that's how I think about it, and we're playing around with what's the best way to do that. You had a couple other parts of your question.
Financing with alternative collateral and integrating communications approaches that reach indirect beneficiaries from the beginning.
Right. I think Judy Payne is here, and I think you should get a chance to talk to her bilaterally about the last one, okay, who is BFS's mobile technologies communication person. My sense is that the indirect stuff is currently being used mostly for nutritional messaging and a little bit less for indirect adoption of the core agricultural technologies, but I think you should take that up with her. In terms of the second issue you raised about alternative forms of collateral, there is some experimentation with that, but I have yet to see it go to scale. If land or other tangible assets are not being used, there usually are co-guarantees. But again, this is a perfect example of why scaling, it's not one size fits all. There are certain countries where finding 5 other people to sign off on this is never going to happen. When I broached this idea in Cambodia, they laughed. They thought I was the funniest thing that had ever set foot in Cambodia, because basically, my next door neighbor was killing me 30 years ago. You think that person's going to co-sign a loan with me? You're crazy. Okay, in other places, it's a complete, the opposite. It's a complete no-brainer. The whole village signs up together, and they get loans no problem. So, you know, again, the social structure, you know, we tend to think of these things as economists, from a sort of an economic design of mitigating risk and, you know, aligning incentives. But these underlying social institutions are equally important. The one thing that I've seen working, but again, I think it needs more time and effort, is I know it's not the only MFI that's doing it, but they're doing a nice job on it. It's called Opportunity. And what they're doing is tranched release and also controlling the cash flow. So in other words, we'll loan you $700 to plant a hectare of corn, but first we only loan you $100 to see that if you actually use it to buy seed, the first round of seed and fertilizer, and we won't pay it to you. We'll pay it to the fertilizer company or the agro dealer. If you do that, we release another $100 to have your field leveled and the row planting done. If that works, et cetera, et cetera. So in a sense, it's sort of like IMF conditionality. You know, we've got these hoops you've got to jump through. It's not so much that we're going to reclaim anything, but it creates sort of an incentive mechanism and an ongoing relationship that seems to be working. I think it's too small to say that this is the next big thing, but I'm sympathetic to that. The one thing I would add, by the way, though, is that there's a real both challenge and problem about developing appropriate risk insurance mechanisms, that particularly for things like buying a new cow, which is often expensive, it just doesn't work if there isn't animal insurance. And so creating viable, because you, for a farmer to, for example, in Kenya, the dairy project is helping farmers switch from traditional cows that produce very little milk, like 5 liters a cow, to European origin breeds that produce 20, 30 liters a cow. But the new cows are often $200-$300 a pop, which for a small farmer is a lot of money, especially if you're going to buy 2, 3, 4 of them. So there's a, I think it was a, IFAD or a different project that had developed an animal insurance that was bundled with the animal, the loan for the animal, and that makes a lot of sense, because if that animal dies and you're left holding the bag for $300, $500, $700, game over. So thank you for the great questions.
This question comes from Michael Doherty. The presentation was primarily about smallholder farmers, but he was wondering if you could address the role of larger farmers as leaders in innovation and their impact on the adoption rates.
I hate to say, I guess it depends what you small and large. Most of the areas that I think Feed the Future programs are working, but I'm not familiar with every 19 countries, is sort of really small farmers tend to be less than a hectare or two. Medium-sized farmers are 2 to 5, and then the larger ones are way above that. I don't think we have, from the experience that I've had, I don't think we have a lot of experience of working with the really large farmers, you know, the ones that are the 10, 20, 30 hectares. Now, the exception to that is that in a few places, there has been some work with things that look more like outgrower schemes. So, for example, there's a large rice producer in Kenya called KPL. I think it's got 3,000 or 30,000 hectares. It's a big farm. It's very commercial, the latest technology. I think it's got $40 or $60 million in investment. And in fact, when the project in the Nafaka project in Tanzania was really originally designed, actually the vision was to use large agribusinesses like this to have some sort of relationship with them, whether it was an outgrower, subcontractor. I mean, what the contractual relationship was going to be was very much a work in progress, and I actually think that needs more work, because I think there are pluses and minuses to those different particular relationships. The expectation was that the government was actually going to induce, through a variety of changes in the policy enabling environment, a large number of other KPLs to come in and be players in the rice and maize and sugarcane business. And at least to date, that hasn't happened yet. So I think this is whoever the caller is. I think Gene Downing is probably a better person to answer this than I am. But at least in the 5 countries I've seen, the only place where it's really being tried is Tanzania. And right now that model is on hold until there are more large-scale partners to work with.
Hi, Patricia DeVecchio, International Purpose. When you look at what you might call as the ideal profile of your adopter or your direct or indirect beneficiary, do you ever look at personal characteristics, like to what degree are they internally motivated? You know, do they feel confident in the success of the project?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I, as you have heard now, I'm an economist by training. One of my little pithy remarks, which is probably not so smart, but I think it's cute, is if you want to scale up, hire an anthropologist, okay? Just because there's so much of an emphasis on the finances, the economics, and the technology, and that human dimension is missing. So I'm aligned with, I think, what's behind your question, but as a non-anthropologist, I don't know how to answer. I mean, I think that's a, I certainly, if I was out there trying to figure out why other people are adopting, certainly the personal characteristics of these influencers or whatever they're called, these nodal farmers, would be one of the things I'd want to be looking at. But I'm personally not capable. I don't have that skill set. So, but I think you're right. I think that's definitely the direction we want to go in.
And we'll take one last question from the webinar. If we didn't get to your question, please do stick around, because I know Richard will be here for a little bit. And if not, feel free to go on the vent page and under comments, post your question, and we'll work with Richard to answer your questions.
Yeah, and just there were a lot of questions coming in through the webinar, and apologies to those of you that I didn't get to ask. This one came from Sierra Versillo through Twitter. She's joining us from Toronto. If agri-dealers are biased to their own products, how can we partner with public sector extension to overcome this? Is this possible or worth prioritizing?
Well, first of all, let me just make a clarification. It's not the agri-dealers who are biased. Agri-dealers are the retail link in the chain in most cases. So it's like, I actually grew up in a rural area. There was an Agway store literally across the street from where I grew up. That's where I bought my guinea pig feed and other things. But agri-dealers carry usually the brands of, I don't know, I've never counted, but I'm sure it's a dozen or more different kinds of fertilizer or seed producers in most countries. And they tend not to be biased unless they're getting particular incentives from a producer to be that way. But the problem is that in most cases, it's variable. The projects are working with agri-dealers to get them to both go out in the field to work with farmers, to advise farmers, and to run demonstration projects. But there's a limit, it appears, to how willing some of them are to do it, especially if it's a sole proprietorship. They don't like to leave their store empty. So actually, there's another important social dimension. In some countries where women, I haven't yet been to a country where the agri-dealers, at least with their own stores, are women, though actually I understand in Haiti they are. Is there somebody else who can take the store so I can go out in the field and work with the farmers? In some countries there is, and they do it, and some countries there isn't. And that seems to be a cultural or social thing. But where the bias comes in is that it's not so much the agro-dealer, it's the seed producer or the fertilizer producer, obviously, doesn't want to tell you that generically this is the best fertilizer. It's why their fertilizer or this is the five kinds they have, and this is the one used here or there, that's the best. And they don't like to tell you about the competition. Well, actually, for your soil, it's really the competitor's fertilizer that's really better. I know there is a project that USAID BFS is running called MIAS, which is, I think it's something to do with building extension systems. I think we've had a very mixed track record on public extension systems, and it's a complicated duck to fix. They usually have all sorts of problems in terms of motivation. They usually lack the sufficient financial resources for both salaries, and particularly for transportation is huge. Often the projects, when they partner with them, are often in a very difficult situation, whereas they can't even get these guys to come and, it's usually men, to come out to the field and even sort of just show the flag, let alone do something actively, if they don't subsidize them in terms of salaries or transportation incentives or per diems, and at the same time we're trying to get away from that. But even if they do it, it's certainly not sustainable. So there are a few places where that's viable. But that's one of those long-term 5, 10, I think 15-year slogs of building the ecosystem that that is the case, which is, I think, why we've moved towards embedded private sector extension in the majority of cases. Now, that said, in Kenya, they've just decentralized agricultural services to the county-by-county level, and actually farmers like extension agents. And so many county people who are allocating their own money are actually putting their money into it, and that's an example where that is working. Ethiopia, which tends to have a very strong state, governance is pretty good, regardless of some of the other issues you might want to raise about the nature of governance in Ethiopia. And they have 60,000 extension workers. So, but, for example, the notion that you're going to make IFAD and USAID are working together to try to make a quasi-private or public sector extension system work. They see it as a 5 to 10 year slog. And right now, it isn't a viable alternative.
Please join me in thanking Richard Cole for an insightful seminar.